Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
This episode of Speak Up was recorded on December 29th, 2020. When you hear the hosts and guests talk about, quote unquote, this year, we are referring to the year 2020. You're tuned in to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM, or the campus community radio station broadcasting at Simon Fraser University on top of Burnaby Mountain. CJSF respectfully acknowledges that we broadcast on the unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kuku'ulam First Nations. This episode of Speak Up was produced on the unceded territories of the Catsi, Kuku'ulam, and Stolo First Nations. You can follow CJSF online on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Instagram by looking up CJSF Radio. My name is Leslie.
And I'm Jade.
And you might have heard our voices on this radio station before. That is because we are the co-hosts of our regular program, typically Tuesdays, which airs on Mondays from 3 to 4. And today we're kind of switching it up. We're doing something new and exciting, talking about labor, talking about food and communication in media. For today's Speak Up, we're joined by guests Clayton and Sarah, who are two of the researchers on a project exploring the work conditions of food couriers in the Metro Vancouver district. This project was conducted by the students of the class Labor, Communication, and the Media at SFU in late January 2020 with the guidance of instructor Dr. Inda Brophy and support from the British Columbia Federation of Labor and the Simon Fraser University Community Engaged Research Initiative. It was completed in mid-April 2020 in the middle of BC's first COVID-19 lockdown. The subsequent report, Food Delivery Platform Work and the COVID-19 Outbreak in the Metro Vancouver Regional District, was published this year in October by SFU. We're really excited to have Clayton and Sarah here on the show today, partly because this was very much a student-led research initiative, also partly because I was a part of it, but that's besides the point. Thank you, Clayton and Sarah, for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
So just as first icebreaker, just introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit more about the roles that you took on this project.
Do you want to go first?
My name's Sarah, and I was part of this class, Communications and Labor Studies joint class. And sort of the largest part that I took on in this project was looking at current legal issues that food delivery drivers were having, not only locally, but globally, and specifically sort of within the context of attempts to unionize and hurdles that workers were facing in how they were framed and how they identified themselves in relation to rights and the platform apps that they were working on.
And my name's Clayton. My part in this project, I kind of worked on the sort of like nitty gritty parts of the project. So I looked with my groups on, for instance, the terms and conditions of these apps. So, you know, what's the fine print and like what are people really signing up for, whether they realize it or not when they do these jobs. And then I also worked a bit on the ethics side of the project. So making sure that we do this in a kind of safe and fair and way that protects everyone who's involved. So that was kind of my two big chunks of work on this.
Cool. So tell us a little bit more about the gist of the project. What exactly was it that you were researching, and who were you doing it with, in what locations? And I'm curious, what spurred the research? What spurred the question?
Well, I think that there was a shift in kind of what we went into, what we had hoped going into it, and then sort of as COVID hit, how it sort of morphed and changed. And I think initially we had sort of gone into it looking at the labor conditions, specifically in the Vancouver Regional District, working conditions of food delivery drivers, as they were using a lot of these food apps that we've probably all are used to, like Uber Eats, Skip the Dishes, mm-hmm. or all these sort of mediating food apps. And so we sort of had gone into it looking at labor conditions and what they were facing in terms of hurdles for unionization. And then I think sort of the conversation shifted a bit around their actual value and role. And so the latter part of our research started to focus on what responsibility these apps had to their, what we sort of were looking at as their employees, even though that's not how they're legally framed. But and what risks they were facing during COVID, and how the sort of public discourse changed completely around who they were to us all as we stayed indoors and got our food delivered to us. They kind of went from being a sort of a convenient thing that we seldom thought about to being almost classified in the media as essential workers. So mm-hmm. I don't know, Clayton, if you want to add to that.
Yeah, I think our instructor, Dr. Nabrofi, came up with this idea and kind of pitched it to us at the beginning of the class as like a kind of like almost like a giant group project, if you will. And that's how it started. And I think it probably kind of, like Sarah said, kind of morphed and evolved into something a little bit bigger, and something probably went a different direction given how this year played out. I think we definitely got to like learn and hear some very interesting perspectives on work from workers who we talked to, and just to kind of understand what they're going through and what their kind of mindset is when they work in these precarious jobs.
Mm-hmm. And so your report is called Food Delivery Platform Work and the COVID-19 Outbreak in the Metro Vancouver Regional District. And it was published earlier this year.
Yeah, the course ended around April, and then it was kind of worked on up until probably sometime in September, October, and that's when it was officially kind of wrapped up.
And before we dive a little bit deeper into the research itself, I noticed that there's a lot of specific terminology surrounding food couriers and this type of work. So before getting to that, maybe can you clarify maybe to the listener what a platform is, and what do you mean by gig work, where the gig economy, where gigs?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, when I think of a platform, it's a digital space, and it's usually in the form of an app or a website. I find that it usually is meant to mitigate something, is the best mm-hmm. I can kind of describe it. So like Facebook is a platform, and it mitigates, you know, communication. And in our case, you know, Uber Eats mitigates work and your ability to get food, for instance. Mm-hmm. So when I think of a platform kind of as a, like a higher level explanation, that's kind of how I think of it, because it doesn't just involve food. A platform can be used in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, what we focused on was sort of platform work, which is sometimes in literature and media coverage sort of treated as interchangeable with gig work. But it's not. Like, gig work has been around kind of forever, and it's usually held in opposition to what we would term sort of the standard model of employment, which is like you go to work every day, you have a set time period, you get benefits from your employer, your hours are like full time, it's not precarious. There's a lot of security in the standard work model. And gig work is seen as sort of like really loosely tied to the labor market. It's often part-time, it's contractual often, you don't have guarantees from an employer necessarily, it's limited work that can be with multiple employers. And gig work sort of covers a wide gamut. The work that we did was only with these food apps where workers interact with these platforms to get their work and offer their labor. But gig work could be, it could be anything from trade jobs to healthcare to elder childcare, cleaning jobs. Gig work is a huge part, I think, of the economy, and increasingly so. And it's also important to note that it's quite gendered and quite racialized as well, with new immigrants to Canada, and also women get worse pay for it, and they often do the bulk of gig work. So they're more at risk for precarious work conditions, non-protection from the employers that they've contracted an agreement with. So I think that that's important to point out too.
Thank you both of you for the really thorough explanations on these terms. When I think back to like reading the report, some of the things that stick out to me are how you conducted the research, and some of it was through observing social media, other methods were interviewing and reading literature. Within all of that, I'm curious to find out, why do food couriers get into the business? What did you find in the research that indicated why people were interested in this industry?
I think the biggest thing that we found was that it was, more often than not, it was extra income, and it was a temporary form of employment. So this was never something that the people we interviewed found would be a permanent job. It was never generally a like long-term goal to be in this position. It was extra money, it was passing time, it was just, I have a couple hours, I can do this. And that's also part of, I think, the appeal of it, is that people like the flexibility and being able to do this on their time, on their hours, and kind of come and go as they please with no real attachment to the job. That's part of the appeal. But we did find, I think, the biggest thing was that most people found it to be a temporary job, just for some extra cash. Yeah.
I think that's an important point too, that Clayton says about that being sort of supplemental, is that that's part of the issue that platform workers face in the gig economy, is that they sort of fall through the cracks data-wise. And I think there was the StatCan report that only recently started gathering data in a bit of a different way, using T4 slips and whatnot. But really, a lot of people, because they weren't able to figure out in Canada how many people are actually involved in the gig economy, because it was often treated as supplemental and non-permanent. So it wasn't being necessarily either seen by the workers themselves as something that they actually were. They weren't saying to themselves, I am a gig worker. They were going to their regular or their part-time sort of more standardized jobs and then doing a bit of this on the side, and weren't really classifying themselves as such. And so, like, we'll talk about it, I think, later, but sort of in the context of unionization, that also makes it hard, because even how workers themselves were defining themselves shifted between workers. Some didn't even consider themselves gig workers, whereas some, you know, did. And so that makes, anytime you have data gaps like that, it makes it really difficult to actually policy-wise sort of know what to do and how to best make sure people are taken care of, and particularly during COVID, right?
So on the other hand of things, like, why are folks getting into this business? What are some of the main issues that workers take when they do this work?
Do you mean in terms of risks that they take on or what they get out of it?
Okay, yeah. I mean, the risks that they take on, maybe also some of the main complaints that they might have.
So I think both Clayton and I did a lot, some transcriptions. There were a lot of interviews, and I did some as well. But I think taking on the work and the risks that they face and the complaints that they have, it's such a mixed bag because, again, going back to that point I made about how they define themselves, the workers that were most likely to define themselves as sort of as self-employed and sort of seeing it only as a very temporary thing had fewer complaints than people that were actually starting to have to rely more heavily upon the work. Because for obvious reasons, the people that just saw it as a passing thing, there's really no initiative or incentive to really change things or complain much because you're your own boss and you move on if you need to, right? But I guess some of the complaints were largely, and maybe Clayton can correct me if I'm wrong, but largely were sort of ambiguity around how the apps worked in like allocating their jobs. There's, I guess, asymmetrical sort of communication where it seemed really clear for them that what they were supposed to do, you log on to the time slot that you want, you do your work and you go. But there were all these sort of algorithms and things that kind of pressured them to maybe take an extra delivery that they didn't necessarily want or push them out of the way of where they actually were located. Things that really made them feel quite managed. And I think there was one report where something like if they had up to 10% of a declining in what they wanted to do, if they wanted to take an order or not, if they had a 10% rate in declining orders, which you would think you would be allowed if you were quote unquote self-employed, you could do whatever you wanted, then they would be bumped down and other high delivery people would get better orders and they would get better locations. And so there's almost like this punishment reward system that they didn't really know how to navigate. And they didn't really know, I think some of the times it almost seemed like it was a little bit arbitrary when they were supposed to be self-employed. I think that was probably the largest complaint, that kind of constant feeling of being not only managed, but kind of watched and penalized for like bumped up or down in ranking. And also how the ranking system works for customers, that, you know, they would get a bad ranking from a customer because the food was not very good, which, you know, is not their fault. It's the restaurant's fault, but they would take the brunt of the ranking, which would then bump them down. So there was all this ambiguity around how things actually worked and it never really seemed to benefit them. So, yeah.
I think Sarah nailed it there. I think the other point that comes to mind for me is safety. And how that shaped up in two ways that I can think of. And the first was that we did all these interviews before COVID. So a lot of that was, for instance, I interviewed a biker and there was issues around safety of, I remember they mentioned to me, for instance, trying to deliver on a bike, but having to carry like a pizza box or something that just doesn't make sense for what they're doing. And the app doesn't really consider that, for instance. And then after COVID, I think a lot of it became issues of health and safety as well. So thinking about, you know, how do they stay protected as in a way, how their work has turned into basically frontline work. And they've, how do they stay safe? How do they stay protected in those situations? So I think that would be another big complaint or a kind of a consistent theme that came up. As we were doing interviews.
And I think too, it has to remember that the sort of in the capitalist landscape that we work in, you know, these platform apps were designed to meet a gap in the market, which the gap in the market is always with the consumer at the end. The consumer is king, as they say. So the effects of whatever the effects are, like you said, Clayton, of like the somebody having to carry like three pizza boxes while driving on a bike in the ice in winter time, that the outcomes of whatever the effects of that app are is not really the issue. The issue is to make a consumer happy. So the apps aren't designed to take into account laborers because they are designed to meet a need of a customer or a consumer. The labor is essentially insignificant in its construction. It's all about efficiency and sort of like a curated lifestyle for the consumer. Can the consumer have the most curated like experience that they want, where they can get all the foods they want, they can get everything they need? The labor is almost completely erased and sort of goes back to the old fetishization of sort of the product, right? Versus where it actually comes from and who's the in-between person, right? Except it's like completely unbundled in the sense that at least before in a factory, there was a very clear indication of who made the product in that line of relationship between the employer and the laborer. And at least they were forced to be taken into account. Whereas now it's almost like the best of everything, where the consumer gets exactly what they want, a company makes the profits, and the laborer is essentially erased. And that's like the ideal, you know, we have no responsibility to the workers. They don't even work for us, they're self-employed. I think that's like the happy life of probably a lot of, if I take a jaded view of companies, right?
Love all this like neo-Marxist and Marxist theory that we're dropping here.
Love all this commodity fetishism. Good old chapter three.
Don't really love it. They're not really.
Oh, no.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie.
And I'm Jade.
We're talking to Sarah and Clayton, who are two of the researchers involved in a student-led research project about food courier labor and platforming media, and also the COVID-19 outbreak. In the report, you talked a lot about the term independent contractors, and actually we talked a little bit about this a few moments ago. What is an independent contractor? What does this classification mean in terms of the industry and then also in terms of our labor laws?
Should I go again?
I can take a stab if you want.
So depressing. Okay, so I think in general, independent contractor, like again, if I'm going to take a jaded view, obviously there are pluses to these sorts of things, but independent contractors essentially offload risk. They offload risk that governments have to take and that companies have to take onto individuals. And that's kind of the outcome. That I'm not saying that's necessarily always the intent. It's often done to save costs to a company where they can outsource certain tasks and whatever to people who are more efficient and actually more qualified. So that can, I like if I was going to run a business, I wouldn't want to do the tech stuff myself because my business would collapse and die. So I might get an independent contractor to come in and do the work for me. So I'm not saying it's all bad and doom and gloom, but I think largely what we're seeing, and actually there was a report on this just recently. I'm trying to think where I saw it from. It was, I think, from the ILO. And they were just saying that is the general trend of labor globally, is that independent contractors are increasing. And the result of it is that risk is falling more and more on the burden on the backs of laborers. So under our labor laws, every province has a different Employment Standards Act that is different than our federal, you know, our federal laws. But in each province, our Employment Standards Acts are meant to protect workers and whatnot. And essentially those have even shifted. And I can talk about that a bit later, but you're looking at more and more people are falling outside of those employment standards controls, because employment standards that are in each province are meant to protect traditional labor. So the labor that you are in a contracted job, you go to work every day, you work your full time, there might be benefits, you have set hours, et cetera, et cetera. Once you are an independent or an entrepreneurial contracted laborer who does essentially odd jobs and does minor jobs contracted out per different employer, you don't fall under those labor laws. So you're considered as an entrepreneur and you take that risk sort of on yourself. So your own benefits are your responsibility. The risks that you take are your responsibility, health risks or whatever. And so essentially the government also doesn't have to pay for any damages that you might have, and you don't have an employer, so they don't have to pay. So it's a very good way, in a cynical sense, of saving the state and saving businesses money, is to classify you as an independent contractor. And actually Clayton had read over a lot of the terms and conditions of those companies. He might want to speak to this.
Yeah, I think the entrepreneur point is a really important one that Sarah brings up, because essentially an independent contractor is someone who works for themselves. They're like their own business in a way, where you are just working for somebody in that sense. And it's usually connected to like a specific service or a specific task that needs to be done. So in this case, food delivery. Yeah, it's kind of painted as this entrepreneurial or like freeing title, where it's you are your own boss and you get to do things your way, when it's not really the case. And the independent contractor kind of, that lingo is put there in every single terms and conditions of these apps, because that is their meat. That's the bread and butter. That's how they work. Without this kind of classification, there's essentially no business model for these apps. So that's like a very critical thing. And it's kind of like I'm not sure the history of it, but like we talked about, being a contractor and having gig work is not a new thing. Like, for instance, I was thinking of like, you know, freelance photographers or arts-based people, like that's a very common thing. But the idea of an independent contractor, I think, is probably like a newer term that's been kind of put in for these apps. And that is the most critical kind of two words they have to put in. Otherwise, they've got no business.
And they have a lot of liability a lot of responsibility and liability if that were to change, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And an interesting thing too, like just to point out, and maybe this ranty part that I'm about to go on, you can edit out later, but the Employment Standards Act, there's a really great book by an SFU professor called Habiba Zaman, and she writes about the experience of Asian immigrants in Canada. It's called Two Canadas. And anyway, she writes around the changes to the Employment Standards Act in BC and how in 2001 and 2002, where just simple things like where Employment Standards Acts are meant to protect laborers, where subtle shifts were made, like where if you had a shift at work and you showed up for work, you traditionally had to pay you 4 hours for your time and energy if they were to send you home for some reason, like they didn't need you or whatever. That got shifted down to where the employer only had to pay you 2 hours. Things like little shifts to overtime, where overtime kicked in at 12 hours instead of 11, things that gave companies greater flexibility, this term flexibility over what to do with their labor force that didn't protect labor, that actually benefited companies. And I think that maybe, this is my own opinion, but maybe in a historical context, as we've very rapidly since the 1980s shifted away from factory type standard work, where the state really needed us to secure labor because we were the producers of the goods that were being exported, then there were employment standards in place to protect that work laborer or employer laborer relationship, because that was like the bread and butter of the state's income was producing. As production has shifted abroad, I do wonder sometimes if maybe that focus of protecting the laborer is slowly getting eroded away in favor of whatever business will come and employ people, because that's part of where we're getting our money from now. But I do think that that's fascinating, this sort of push, like you said, Clayton, this newer thing of idolizing entrepreneurship and idolizing, oh, you're your own boss, you're your own contractor. It's problematic in a lot of ways.
It's a lot of like PR hot words and keywords that they love to use, for yeah. sure.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, like, very thorough and in-depth analysis. Feels like I'm right back in the classroom, which is really great. Something that I, strangely enough, in this quarantine, actually quite miss. So in your report, social media plays a really big role, not only in how you conducted your research, but also in the lives of the food couriers. One of the things that I think about seen in the report is the section where you talk about how food couriers use social media. And then somebody says, well, basically they just use social media to complain about people not tipping them, which is very, very, very apt, quite bleak, but very, very apt. So I'm wondering, you talk about how social media can also play a big role in collective organizing when it comes to how food couriers kind of exist and grapple with their work. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I think the way these apps are designed, these food apps are designed, are that they're for independent work. You don't really interact with or see or know who else is around you who might be, you know, doing that work. It's meant for you and for you alone. Unlike, you know, a regular office or something where you might see someone else, there's none of that in this setting. And what happens with that is people are finding other ways to meet and to talk and to interact. And a huge part of that is because of social media. So for instance, there are Facebook groups. Different platforms have different ways, but that was one of the big ones, was Facebook groups and how they're joining them so that they can talk to each other. And it's kind of like this grassroots organic building of a community in a way, because they all have this common thread of they're all working for these apps, and they kind of built this community for themselves when no one else would do it for them. So that is kind of how I saw social media, I think Sarah will speak to this more, but how I saw social media playing a role in their jobs is that they don't have that space in any other setting. So they kind of carve out their own space, and this is how they do it.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly it, Clayton. I think the whole fascinating thing is that weird dichotomy as, it's kind of like Jurassic Park, the first one, and only I can quote it because I was there when it came out and I'm older than you guys. But it's like when the guy, what's his name? He says about, you know, they've genetically engineered these dinosaurs to not be able to procreate as like a foolproof way of controlling everything. And he's like, life always finds a way. And I think that there's a fascinating thing that, like, as much as these mediating apps hyper individualize the workers and set them apart, it's opaque. They don't really understand how the algorithms work. There's no like guide to, in the terms and conditions of how, you know, oh, well, if you, you know, decline this many things, this is what happens. There's no clear terms and conditions in terms of rules on how anything works. So they live in this like individualized ambiguity. But ironically, it's also platforms that then provide them with alternate ways of connecting and finding ways around this hyper-individualization, which is fascinating. It's like anytime you clump laborers together, even if you try and put them in their own cubicles or you try and do whatever, people are going to find a way to find commonalities with each other. And I think there was a part in the report about in COVID times, you know, people giving each other tips on how to stay safe and how to stay, you know, what about fears about touching things and being in elevators in crowded conditions. And so, you know, finding ways to reach out to each other because they realized that each other were in the unique position of understanding what they were going through and the fears that they were having during COVID were all in common. And the threats that they faced were all in common and unique to them as delivery workers. So I find that fascinating. It's like you have this maybe not necessarily malicious intent to compartmentalize and individualize workers. That might not even have been, it might just be, oh, we need to fill a gap in the market, whatever. But the effect of it being hyper-controlled, individualized workers, then them using the similar apps and, you know, hidden names or whatever to then reconnect and find ways around being in, isolated.
I think actually, well, I think it's, that's really incredible. And also something that I just, as a consumer of food and a consumer of food apps have noticed is that there's a lot of subreddits, you know, just taking ground of, with different, there's one, I know there's like a r/UberEats, there's an r/DoorDash, and I stumbled upon them by accident because I'm fairly new to using food delivery apps. I don't really use them a lot, but during the pandemic, definitely I've started using them, and I wasn't really aware of a lot of the social etiquette around tipping and taking calls and communication. So I ended up going on a lot of these subreddits, and after getting my fill of the information I needed, I stayed around a little more just to look at how people are talking to each other. And these aren't even people in local communities. These are people, you know, across the globe. And there's really a sense of, if not solidarity, at least there's a sense of commiseration that I found. And then I have another story. I don't think this can make it up on air because there's a lot of holes in this story, but I just kind of wanted to share with you guys because it has to do with social media and organizing and unions. And this happened a few years ago. My uncle worked at a casino in Richmond, and he told me the story about how this casino won their union through exclusively the use of WeChat. Basically, all the workers were fed up with the conditions. And they ended up, but most of the workers are racialized, they're immigrants, they might not be English speakers, and they don't know a lot about labor laws. So I think someone from, I don't know who it was, but a labor organizer ended up creating a WeChat group, recruiting people, and it became like a huge thing. And that's how they ended up getting their signatures to form a union, and they ended up winning the union. And I thought that was really, really cool.
That's often how it starts. It's just some sort of, you know, small startup somewhere in a, you know, in a WeChat, in a Facebook group, in a WhatsApp group. That's often how it starts. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was cool.
That's really interesting that you mentioned that too. Also, Jade, because I think in the report it says that, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later on, but it mentions that actually a number of the people who were interviewed when asked about the prospects of unionization, they had like very little clue as to how labor laws affected them.
Right.
So it's really quite remarkable how people are banding together.
It might be
bad. Trying to sort that and trying to sort that all out.
Yeah, it was really cool because this was when, like, I got the playbook when this was happening, like in real time, when like my uncle was like giving me all the deets, and then he was like, yeah, we won the union, and it was all through WeChat. It was really incredible and fascinating, and I don't know, just a good story, a fond story that I have. Anyways, let's get back to this thing.
Staying in the recording, by the way.
Okay.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM. We are joined today by Clayton and Sarah, who are two of the researchers on a project called Food Delivery Platform Work and the COVID-19 Outbreak in the Metro Vancouver Regional District. This was a research project conducted last year by students of the class Labor, Communication, and the Media at SFU. And they're here to talk to us all about their report that was recently published by the same name of the project. And yeah, take it away, Jade.
So for me, the unique thing about this project, and I think this happened to a lot of social scientific research projects this year, and I wouldn't say it's serendipitous because this has been a really tough year. We're in the middle of a pandemic, but it began conception in the early months of 2020, and the COVID pandemic sort of disrupted the initial design of your research, which affected how you did research. But more importantly, it did also impacted the gig workers that you were working with. Tell us a little bit more about how the pandemic affected workers. How did platforms respond to it, and how did workers respond to it?
Go ahead, Clayton.
Sure. I think I was thinking back to when I said earlier that these workers went from, when COVID-19 hit, these workers went from doing kind of temporary side hustle, side gig jobs, or seeing it that way, to essentially being frontline workers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the most interesting shift. And it also kind of inadvertently shifted how people saw frontline workers, especially like how the media writes about them, how they're kind of portrayed. They're kind of seen in a different perspective now, or a different light, because of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of safety, I think a lot of companies probably didn't do enough, I would say, to look out for their workers, their quote unquote workers. There was a lot of holes of, you know, how do we stay protected? Where do we get, you know, simple things like hand sanitizer or gloves or masks and things like that? And there wasn't a lot of communication in that sense. So in some ways, I do believe in the kind of sense that we got was that some of these workers definitely felt like they were left high and dry in certain mm-hmm. situations.
I had just read an OECD report about the shift in platform workers during COVID a couple days ago. But yeah, like what Clayton said is right. Like there wasn't a lot of response. There were responses, which I think is actually really fascinating because it undermines platforms' claims that they are not employers. So the interesting thing is that there were like, I think DoorDash had actually implemented up to 2 weeks pay. They had even done, I think, reimbursement for childcare, realizing that schools were closed and none of their drivers could actually drive because they had to be at home and be looking after kids. So there were all these little, like really what we would consider minor things probably compared to standard work where you might get actually real benefits and real care and real sick days and whatever. But there were these little measures on different platforms all over in Europe and in North America where there was a little bit of compensation given, or they would try to suggest on their apps that consumers tip more, or please clean your doorknobs before you are expecting a delivery worker or a care worker or whatever to come into your home. So there was a little bit of where these companies suddenly stepped up. And I tend to be quite cynical in that I'm not saying that these platform companies aren't concerned that they're totally immoral and horrible people. I'm not saying that, but I think a lot of that was because of the public pressure and the change in discourse in media around the value of platform workers. So once everyone started lauding these delivery drivers who were bringing us food and, you know, bringing care to people who were disabled and whatever, and clapping at 7 o'clock every night for workers who were out there front lines, I think suddenly the shift happened that, oh, our consumers value these people. Therefore, we should probably provide them with a bit of PPE, even if it's like literally just gloves and a sanitizing spray, which, you know, is piecemeal and whatever. But I think there was a step up there. which I think very much will in court cases, which I can talk a bit about later, but court cases will undermine then their terms and conditions stance that you're an independent contractor. We have no obligation to you. Your own thing is your own. Because yeah, there was some interesting stuff where, you know, they Uber driver cars, like they were given like, if you don't have a car, don't have access to a car during COVID, we can lend you one and we'll give you better policy rates. And there were all these little things that very specifically go against that claim that we have no employer-employee relationship. So that will be fascinating to see if that carries on or if we all just go back to normal and we sort of in a classist way push food delivery workers back down to the bottom instead of maintaining that they are essential frontline workers.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we've talked a little bit about this earlier, but I've read in your report that you've observed during the pandemic workers demonstrating some pretty high levels of quote unquote mutual aid and solidarity. So my question is, through what forms and avenues did these acts of mutual aid and solidarity take place? How did this all impact, if it did impact, if it had any impact to begin with, the ways that contractors see themselves?
I think there was like a really large sense of camaraderie, again, on those same social media platforms that we were talking about earlier. There was this definitely sense of like, we're all in this together kind of state of mind, and like it was very simple things sometimes, like, you know, how do we stay safe, where do we find supplies, you know, how do we pass off orders without, you know, potentially putting ourselves in harm's way and things like that, and just giving each other tips how to get a hold of the platform, you know, little things like that where they would give each other help. And I think the academic term is embryonic solidarity, where just, again, because they have this common thread of being food delivery workers, they have that kind of similarity, and that's how they built community, and that's how they got along, and that's how they helped each other.
I think that was great. I have nothing to add.
Thank you so much for that thoughtful answer. And we also talked about this a little bit, but before the pandemic, you said, Sarah, I think you said most mainstream media discuss the platform economy and gig work in very apolitical terms, focusing usually on the corporate and business side of things and not really on labor or work. But this has shifted after COVID. It's not during COVID. And it changed quite drastically when the pandemic came. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that largely, and Leslie was doing a lot of this looking at media coverage as well. I think that was a main chunk of what she was doing. So she can probably actually put in a few good points here. But I think a big thing that we have to realize with general media is that sort of business takes primacy. So as well as consumers' needs. So generally, I think platform workers, specifically food delivery drivers or like Uber drivers, it's just seen as and painted as it's convenience for the consumer. And you can't really disagree with that because we all are living in these really really sort of fast-paced lives that seem to be almost increasingly so. There's very little demarcation between your work life and your personal life and your at-home life. If you're lucky, maybe you get a job with a good work-life balance, but for the large part with platforms and emails and whatever, there is very little, there's very little demarcation of having your own time. And so with that, as we are all in employees and we are also consumers, comes these needs to have a faster, easier life. And if a cab can't get you in time, why wouldn't you want an Uber to come and get you so that you make it to work on time? If you can't cook, why would you, you know, want to buy some frozen pizza when you could actually order a fresh pizza from your favorite place down the road. There's all these things that these are very clear needs that we do have as average sort of people living in society. And so to be painted that way, it's not entirely unfair that yes, it is convenient and yes, it is useful for us. And it's good for business in the sense that it's creating different kinds of jobs. But I think the big hole that's always there is like, the quality of jobs that are created is not discussed. The precarities with those jobs are not discussed. If it has any sort of downward pressure on wages and pushes wages downward, what it does to small businesses that are barely surviving. I think an interesting point that we didn't discuss, you know, sort of in the media coverage of being very much like, this is convenient for you, go out and, you know, you can order your food to your door. Another interesting thing that I was thinking about when I reread our report, I was like, we didn't even talk about waitresses and small food places where an app is taking a cut of the food and where you would normally go into a restaurant and you would tip usually a gendered workforce of waitresses, where you would tip a waitress, though your tip is now going to a DoorDash delivery driver, which is grand, but the waitress is still in the restaurant scrambling to organize the food, put the names on all the bags and do all that work, but they're not actually getting anything out of it. So, you know, the disruptions to the industries that exist aren't mentioned in media. Mm-hmm. So there's all this stuff that isn't talked about, and it's only sort of painted in this glossy, this is a great thing, but it's actually not, because even the apps themselves aren't even stable. Like some of them just close up shop immediately, or like Foodora left Canada once workers tried to do something. So it's like, it's not even stable work, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, Leslie, I don't know if you want to add to the media coverage part, or Clayton.
I don't think there is much to add there. I think you make like a really good point about sort of like the discussions about the hospitality industry that we, for whatever reason, could not have in our report. I think fundamentally, like, the interesting thing was really like the shift in how we framed, or I guess how mainstream media started framing labor, right? Because I guess at first you could say like these food couriers and the labor conditions that they face, they weren't really highlighted that much in mainstream media. The only times when it would happen is when there would be some kind of like labor movement or like a strike or something like that, and it really started to disrupt the lives of everyday people and also disrupt the corporations, such as the unionizing of Foodora workers in Toronto and the rideshare workers in California. But then after the pandemic, we really started to see, like, I think maybe the first 2 or 3 weeks when the pandemic hit BC, we started to see very often trending articles about how poorly workers were being treated, and tying it all into the rest of the report, how laborers found an avenue to become more vocal. Even after, I think, we were done our interviews, we kept sharing articles with each other through our main channel of communication to talk about like how things were shifting in some way.
I'm really glad that both you, Leslie and Sarah, brought up Foodora, because I was just gonna get there. I think it's time we talk about unionization. So how do workers, this is the what is to be done section of the interview. How do workers view the prospects of unionization? What potential do you see here specifically in Vancouver?
Oh, Lord. I think you go, Clayton, first.
Okay. The first thing that comes to mind with that question is that it's really hard. I think the main reason it's really hard is because these workers aren't, like I talked about, these are mostly temp jobs, side hustles, and things like that. Right. So most people aren't around long enough for to really care, quite frankly. It's not, again, it's not generally their only income. And because it's so temporary, most people don't see unionize, they've never considered unionization. It's not just, it's just not something they've thought about. But maybe it could be something worth exploring. I don't know if you want to speak into that, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hopeful version of it, in the sense that what Clayton had talked about before was that sort of embryonic solidarity, that there were all these ways that workers were actually reaching out to each other, giving each other tips, a sense of that we're in this together, I think is really key for any possibility of unionization, to see yourself as a group rather than an individual. But we already talked about how almost impossible that is, in the sense, even from the self, the self-description of these workers, a lot of in the interviews, it wasn't just that they didn't know the processes of unionization. They didn't even perceive themselves necessarily as being a gig worker for long. It was just a side hustle. It was just a side thing. So that sort of temporal nature of the job, where it's high turnover and it's only for a little while and it's just supplementary, that undermines any sort of long-term thinking about it as a job. And I would assume because it's physically demanding as well, that makes it even more difficult. But I think if you look on the legal end of it, which we talked about a little bit, I think a real hurdle for unionization is the fact that these workers go into their terms and agreement contracts, signing on the dotted line that they are in fact independent contractors, and that the company doesn't owe them anything, and that there is no relationship there. And in fact, some of the terms and conditions are actually not just that there's no relationship that maybe you could contest in court or whatever, but it's actually that if you are going to contest anything, here's all these things around jurisdiction and whatever. It was like the one in Ontario, when Uber drivers were looking at maybe even class action. Well, class action, you can't have a class action when you're one person as an individual contractor. Like, you're not, you don't even fall under the right category. So, and then if there was dispute, Uber had framed that, well, you have to go to the Netherlands. There's always private arbitration first. That's the only port of call for complaints. And it's as an individual against the company, and the arbitration headquarters are in Netherlands. So who's going to go? And so I think the problem is that you're looking at, it's so, like, in the legal world, it's such a fragmented approach. So for example, say you're a worker in Ontario and you're with Uber, and they're like, okay, you're an independent contractor. If you have any complaints, it's private arbitration, and it has to be in the Netherlands. So thankfully, a lot of employment standards acts have clauses that essentially protect workers to have a channel of complaint. You have to have a channel of complaint. You either have to have a labor board to go to, or like courts, through the court system. But the burden rests on the worker to then take it either to a labor board or take it to court to say that, first of all, we're not even talking about unionization. I just want the right to not have to go to private arbitration. I want the right to be able to take up my grievance against Employment Standards Act, and maybe through a court system where it's heard in front of a judge rather than private arbitration. So you're not even talking about unionization or any sort of rights as an employee to an employer. You're actually still at the base fighting for just a proper channel to put your grievance in. And that in itself can take a whole thing, and courts don't even agree. So the Ontario Supreme Court, or the lower courts, said, no, you signed on the dotted line, the arbitration that Uber had lined out, well, that sucks for you, but you signed on the dotted line, and that's their terms and conditions. So too bad. And then they had to go to the appeal court. And appeal court said, no, actually that's invalid. Like, you have to have a proper channel of complaint that fits standard, you know, employment standards and whatever. So through all that, like, expenses of going through the court system, through lower courts and then upper court, that's only just to say that you actually have the right to not have to fly to the Netherlands to complain. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah. And then because Employment Standards Acts are different for every province, And depending on the court's decisions, you're fighting so incrementally. So literally, like, the right to class action, that's not even a right to unionize. That's just a right to say that you can form a class action and then fight as a group. That's not even, like, you know, so it's just like, sometimes I feel like the incremental wins are great, but they're not uniform, and they're going to change depending on province, and what you're fighting for will change depending on the terms and agreements for each platform thing. And then, for example, the Foodora one, when you do win and you do say get a right to unionize or a right to be seen as maybe somewhat employees, then Foodora's like, well, we're going to stop operations in Canada. Bye. So it's sort of just like, it's such a long road to any sort of tangible, solid, non-precarious existence for a lot of these workers, right?
Yeah. It's frankly pretty Kafkaesque, the way that you've described it. But
on those workers who are what getting like super minimum wage. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Also trampled by bureaucracy.
Totally.
But thank you for that very thorough breakdown of how much work we have left to do.
Yeah.
But for those who might be interested in learning more about this project, and I think we all should be learning more about this, where can we find out more?
Well, Clayton, what have you been doing for more information these days?
A lot of news articles generally. That's usually where I find is where I get most of my information from. I was reading, like, for instance, a couple weeks ago, I was reading about Prop 22 in California. And that was really big one that we didn't really touch on here, but that's okay. So, you know, reading up on things like that and seeing where legislation and people have tried to make a change and where oftentimes it hasn't worked, I think is really important. And also our full report, I believe, is on the SFU website as well. So you can also find that there if you're interested in reading more about it or seeing it in detail.
All right, then. Thank you so much, Sarah and Clayton, for joining us on Speak Up today. Got a lot of really interesting insights and analysis on labor and media and food. I mean, we really appreciate that you could share this with us, especially because this is very much an important project, but it's also really important for us as independent media to share that there is intellectual work being done by people who aren't just academics, maybe part academics, I guess, because we were students at one point. So thank you so much for coming on to the program. And again, for those who are more interested, for those who are interested in learning more about this project, you can Google search food delivery platform work and the COVID-19 outbreak in the Metro Vancouver Regional District. That is a report that has been published by SFU and a number of partners on this project. And you can learn all about the cool stuff that went down.
Fantastic. Thanks, Leslie and Jade, so much for having us on. That was really fun.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks for showing up.
We had such a wonderful, thoughtful, engaging discussion with Clayton and Sarah that, unfortunately, we had to cut some of it out because we ran out of time for this air slot. But if you're interested in listening to more of our conversation, such as the interesting academic work that Sarah has been reading about gendered and racialized labor in Canada, then you can go to cjsf.ca, look into featured programs, and you will find our full interview there. So check us out on cjsf.ca, featured programs, January 5th's Speak Up broadcast. Be sure to stick around for more great CJSF programming. Thank you so much for tuning in to Speak Up today. You're going to be hearing Democracy Now! coming up next from 11 to 12 every day from Monday to Friday with your host, Amy Goodman. So stick around for that.